Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week we're talking about Wes Anderson's new film Isle of Dogs and the BBC adaptation of Ordeal by Innocence.
We've also listened to the Tyler, the Creator album Flower Boy for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. I'm in such a good mood today just because the sun's come out in London. It just makes my life so much better.
I know. Don't you find that you persist all through the winter and then into the bedraggled early grey bits of spring and you're like, oh, maybe I need to go to the doctor, like,
yeah,
maybe there's
totally
something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And then the first sunny day you're like, oh no, actually I'm fine,
totally
it's just
fine.
The weather.
I'm fine. Fine, yes. Now. Yeah, that's how I feel. I'm also currently accepting applications for my summer crush.
Right, sure.
Only requirements must be handsome and boring enough for me to project all my fantasies onto. Total unavailability also required. Applications being accepted until, I don't know, May. Because we really need it locked down for the whole summer. So
okay.
So I've just been kind of like reading a bit of my book here and there and having a quite jolly old time of it, actually.
Yeah, I'm really, really hoping that this weather is going to stay and that now it's just plain sailing into the summer.
I demand summer. No take backsies weather.
Yes, because I'm also ready for the kind of pop culture that goes with it being nearly summer as well.
Mm.
I'm through with, you know, films with serious heavy subjects. Please give me ones with loud bangs in now.
Yeah. Okay. So last week we talked about Hamilton because we both actually have seen it in London now, which was a great fun episode to do. And we've had some really lovely listener feedback. So we're going to read a couple of emails about Hamilton. Catherine got in touch with us to say she's listening to the Hamilton special right now and I'm loving it. And then she says, you discuss how neither of you knew that John Lawrence dies, which was actually an intentional choice by Lin-Manuel Miranda. He grew up listening to cast recordings and loved when there was a withheld moment that was a surprise to someone who knew the recording by memory. And she links to a Tumblr post where Lin-Manuel Miranda's basically like, here is the scene from Hamilton in which Lawrence dies and this is the only, quote, scene in Hamilton because everything else happens via song rather than via dialogue. And he says, as someone who grew up only listening to cast albums, those withheld moments were revelations to me when I finally experienced them on stage years later. Hamilton is sung through and I wanted to have at least one revelation in store for you. I stand by the decision and I think the album is better for it. Please understand that the reason that I left this scene off the album is precisely because I value it and Lawrence so much. Which is great. So we weren't totally stupid. I was like, we're just so dumb.
Yeah, but also it's so interesting that he deliberately did it as like a kind of Easter egg for seeing it live in theatre. Mm. But then also, I think he's right that if you had that like spoken word scene on the album, it would feel like I would just find myself skipping it all the time. In the same way that I do with the Hamilton mixtape album, I skip the stupid Jimmy Fallon track every time, like almost like a reflex because no one needs that.
Yeah, I did really experience that as a new emotion in the theatre as well, which obviously with a lot of it you don't because you know every twist and turn that's happening. And like the sort of little extra jokes that are all based on physicality, it was so fun to see that because it was, well, not fun because I was really sad because I was like, no, my fave. But yeah, great. So thank you, Catherine, to give us a little bit of extra context there.
We've also heard from Eric, who actually got in touch via our website. I sort of forgot that I put a contact form on there, but I'm glad that it still works. And he says, regarding Hamilton, I wonder if the problem you had with the ending was the fault of the actress playing Eliza. I saw Philippa Sue in the show when it opened in New York, and her performance was so subtle. In fact, I saw her years earlier in the off-Broadway production of Natasha, Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. And when I saw the Broadway version of that show without her, I realized how much she grounded the role of Natasha because her Broadway replacement was overdoing everything. I think Eliza is a similar type of role that's more complex and challenging than people realize. I really agreed with this interpretation, I think, because just to recap for people who maybe didn't hear it, if we had a criticism of the London production of Hamilton at all, it was the fact that the ending was quite overwrought. Particularly there's this one bit where Eliza goes, "The orphanage," in a really sort of operatic way.
Which was the subject heading of Eric's email.
Yeah. And we just found that really silly and slightly like put a dampener on my weeping at the end, really, because it made me laugh. So yeah, I do think that it's much more to do with the performance than the writing, because I think perhaps in a different actor's hands.
I don't know, though. The orphanage as a line is just, I mean, the orphanage, I don't know. For me, it's just the idea that it's like, by the way, if this wasn't sad enough, let's chuck some orphans in the mix.
But it is literally what happened. Like, she did find an orphanage.
I know, but so, you know, what is history? What is truth? I also really appreciate Eric just getting in there that he saw the show when it opened in New York, brackets, where I live. Look at Eric going to see Hamilton when it opened. All right, Eric.
Yeah, get
bully you. For you. But thank you so much for all the Hamilton emails. What a great fun episode of Seriously To Do.
So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Isle of Dogs, which is a stop motion animated film directed by Wes Anderson and set in a dystopian near future Japan. It follows the adventures of a group of dogs exiled to an island made of trash after an epidemic of dog flu breaks out. Bryan Cranston, Greta Gerwig, Bill Murray and Frances McDormand lead the cast of voice actors.
Yeah, so it's quite a Wes Anderson-ish premise, I think. The idea of this island where all the dogs are forced to live amongst the garbage with no cure for their supposedly aggressive and infectious disease that they have. And I think even the title sounding a bit like I Love Dogs, you'll already feel like you're fully in like, ooh, sprightly, effervescent, quirky Wes Anderson mode. And then the plot is actually surprisingly complex. It's not like a simple, like Fantastic Mr. Fox style, the farmer's out to get the fox style plotline. There's a lot of weird political stuff that Wes Anderson has weaved into this story.
Yeah, there is, because as you go through the film, the mayor of the city that the dogs have been exiled for undergoes a bit of a sort of journey, in that you may think at the start that he's taking the right decision to exile the diseased dogs to save the human population, and then it gradually you start to question whether maybe actually he just hates dogs and that he's cooked up this whole thing in order to get rid of dogs. And there are a few like comic moments that tease that out, but yeah, it's not straightforward. The goodies and baddies move around a bit. It's not clear who's who all the time.
Yeah,
and some of the dog characters also go on personal journeys as well.
One thing that's interesting is that the dogs speak English. You know, there's a note at the beginning of the film that says something like all barks have been translated into English, but Japanese remains in Japanese, and it's subtitled, and you get like Frances McDormand verbally translating for like a supposed American English audience watching a political rally, things like that.
Yeah, she plays the interpreter essentially. So whenever, because quite a lot of the exposition is done via news reports or like filmed transmissions of speeches or rallies, and she's the like interpreter for that. So yeah, the way he gets across the like people and dogs can't understand each other is to have them speak two different human languages rather than there being any barking. Apart from in the case of the character called the Little Pilot and his guard dog, because they have these little earpieces that they wear and they seem to be able to talk to each other through those.
Yeah. It's very beautifully designed, this film, isn't it? Like, all the stop motion looks amazing. Even the trash island looks, you know, beautiful in its way, even though it's a very kind of like grim, almost dystopian landscape. And then it's kind of like interweaved with all these references to Japanese art and like 1960s Japanese poster style and right back to very traditional art influences. And it's kind of like this big melting pot of different aesthetic references. And I really enjoyed looking at it. And I enjoyed, you know, some of the kind of like quirks that of like split screen and stuff like that that he uses kind of halfway through. But for me, the storyline was like a little bit boring. And I think one thing I struggled with is that the five lead dogs, like, what a great opportunity, five stop animation dogs to like really bring some kind of like weirdness and personality into the film. And all five of those dogs are like really boring, interchangeable men. And they've all got names like, you know, Boss and King and... And then they're all kind of like fairly wholesome, all-American boys. That's everyone's vibe, apart from the Bryan Cranston lead dog is like a little bit more
edgy,
grumpy. And what's that word beginning with M that means grumpy? I always forget.
Misanthropic.
Yeah, exactly. For me, like I just felt like that was a bit of a wasted opportunity because we get a few other dogs coming in who suddenly are like, oh, wow, this is what this film could have been. So there's a Tilda Swinton pug. A pug voiced by Tilda Swinton called Oracle, who is, quote, like, has visions because she basically watches old TVs. But they think this that her watching these TVs is her having, like, a weird vision. And she's just such a comedy, pint-sized, brilliant little side character in the film. And I'm like, oh, all of the dogs could have had this sort of energy and this sort of presence.
They could have had personalities.
Yeah, and instead they don't. And even the Scarlett Johansson girl dog, her like character is like Smurfette. She's like, I'm the girl dog, so I've like got a higher voice and nicer fur.
And that's
you're
it.
Like, yeah, cool, that's fun. I feel like the same thing with the human characters is that they're kind of like playing roles rather than like being interesting characters. So you have loyal kid looking for his dog. And then you have like student protester, and then you have like devoted scientist, and then you have power hungry mayor. And those are like the other characters in the film, and they're not actual. I mean, I know it's a lot to ask in an animated film that's kind of silly and about one dog's journey to find his master or whatever, but I kind of wanted more from all of those parts because they just felt a bit flat to me.
I also think it is totally possible, as we've seen in films like Up and Inside Out.
And even Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
Like he
can have
great
characters. Yeah. So yeah, I know there's been a fair amount of chat of people saying that this film doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
Oh really?
Even though it's like a stop motion animated film about,
about dogs.
it's true, it doesn't, because there's barely any female characters in it, and they really only have like flirty scenes with male dogs. And that's it.
Don't you feel like an idiot for criticising things like that? But it is also annoying.
But it is also annoying. Yeah. And it's annoying partly because of like gender roles, but it's also annoying because it's really just a function of the fact that quite a lot of the characters are quite similar and don't really, even as you say, like I don't think I would have really noticed if the main five lead pack dogs had actually had variety and distinct personalities. Like when I looked at the cast list, I was like, wow, Jeff Goldblum was in this. Even though they've got some incredible voice actors playing those lead dogs, I barely really registered who was voicing
them
because what they had to say was just so generic
and it just felt quite interchangeable. And like lots of it, there's kind of like funny jokes, like I would laugh when, you know, the dogs were making little kind of like coded references to what it might actually be like to like be in love as a dog, like that, you know, there's all these kind of quips about like, oh, the dogs I like are never in heat or whatever. But beyond that, it's kind of like it's not really doing anything interesting. One thing we should talk about is that there's been lots of discussion about cultural appropriation in regards to the way that Wes Anderson treats Japanese culture in this film and whether it's basically like Orientalism. And I've read loads of good stuff on this on the internet, and we'll put some links in the show notes. But I wanted to shout out to Simran, who's been on this show before, Simran Hans, who's a film critic for The Observer and other places. And she wrote a really great piece for Reverse Shot about this. And she said, not all of the film's evocations of Japan translate as benign. Repeated images of cotton wool mushroom cloud explosions conjure the American World War II bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Elsewhere, peas of green wasabi paste are repurposed as poison, a joke about deadly foreign fare that feels like low-hanging fruit. This pick and mix of cultural signifiers half-heartedly introduces a series of coded ideas about, quote, Japanese-ness that the film has no interest in actually engaging with, which I thought was sort of a good summation of how Japanese culture really works in the film. It's kind of like a thing to look at and point at.
It's absolutely a spectacle, but nothing else. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think she's bang on with that. And it actually weirdly reminded me a little bit of, I don't know if you've ever played the video game Bioshock.
No.
Well, Bioshock is set in this kind of steampunk city state, which is just it's not obviously based on any one existing culture. It's just a kind of mashup created of lots and lots of different things that the writers have imagined. But it's used in exactly the same way as like a spectacle for you to walk around and see, but you don't really necessarily have to engage with what it's about or what its ideas are. And that's fine in a video game when it's just totally made up. But I really didn't like feeling that I was watching a film that was doing that same thing with a real culture.
Yeah.
I was like, why? This is almost like a background in a video game, apart from this is like real people's ideas and identities that is being done.
It's funny because I feel like a lot of the defenses of this are like, you know, it's just a setting. Why does he have to set his film in America? What, like, you know, he's just set his film in Japan. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you're talking about someone like Wes Anderson, where how things look and the visuals are like actually the substance of his films, you can't just dismiss it as just like the decoration for the film.
Also,
right?
I tried to suspend judgment because while I was watching it, I, you know, like Simran says, I was seeing the mushroom clouds and being like, but I was like, I'm just going to suspend judgment until I see the credits, because if I see that Wes Anderson's is the only Western name involved in making this film, I'll go, fair play.
Yeah,
but it's not like literally there's almost, well, not that you want to make too many judgments based just on names, but from what I could tell, there are almost no Japanese people involved in making this film.
One of the producers is Japanese, and you know, in a lot of interviews, Wes Anderson has really credited him with being extremely important to how they developed their ideas about Japan, and you know, being really important in whether or not to translate and all of this kind of stuff. But one Japanese name doesn't necessarily feel like enough. Again, you don't want to do things based on like quotas and stuff like that, because it just gets silly, but something felt a little bit off about it. Like the wasabi paste is a good example, where wasabi paste is poison and it feels very much like a kind of American's joke of what wasabi is. It's not sort of really based in any reality. And Simran at the end of her piece, I think, has quite a damning line where she says, given the painstaking intricacies and aesthetic inflexibility of Anderson's imagined worlds, it would be naive to write off this uneasy detail as an oversight, or even less likely as a design flaw.
Yeah, there's nothing unintended in his films, is there? Like everything he does is very, very intentional and deliberate. So yeah, you can't really excuse it on that basis.
Yeah. But anyway, I'd love to hear seriously listeners' thoughts about Isle of Dogs, whether they enjoyed it, whether they thought it was guilty of any cultural appropriation sins, or whether that's taking it all a bit too seriously. pun
that's
intended.
What we do here.
Yeah. Yeah, so do email in with your thoughts.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The next thing we're going to talk about is Ordeal by Innocence, a BBC adaptation of the 1958 novel of the same name by Agatha Christie. It focuses on the aftermath of the murder of Rachel Argyle, played by Anna Chancellor, the adopted mother of five children. One of them, Jack, has died in prison after being accused of her murder, yet on the eve of their father's remarriage, a man turns up claiming to be Jack's alibi. Now, if you're a seriously listener, you will probably know a lot about the context of this adaptation. So this was originally meant to air in Christmas 2017, as they have done every year for the last 3 years, I want to say. The BBC have put on an Agatha Christie adaptation over the Christmas period. And because of the allegations surrounding Ed Westwick, this was pulled originally. But they actually refilmed Ed Westwick's character's part. He was replaced by Christian Cook. So having reshot his scenes, it's now ready to air. And it's started over the Easter break and they're doing one a week, which has also been controversial because BBC viewers are so used to having their Agatha Christie. This is like one of the most British things of all time. British audiences complain that their Agatha Christie adaptation, each episode is too far apart in time. They want it all at once.
Yes, because often they do, I think with And Then There Were None and stuff, they did them on like consecutive nights between Christmas and New Year. I saw an amazing article in the Telegraph that managed to spin this as a like generational war thing. Thing like, old people are happy to have TVB on one episode per week, just like in the good old days. Millennials are frustrated because it is not
I wonder what
player.
The millennial audience for this show is. I'm sorry, but I think it's pretty like middle-aged persons watching anyway.
Yeah, and I don't think it's that big a deal, to be honest, you know.
It's a tradition to have the Agatha Christie come 3 days apart, and so I was kind of also like, ooh, with a murder mystery, you kind of want to binge it, but yeah. My boyfriend floated the theory that because they were still in post-production trying to seamlessly re-edit Ed Westwick's part, they couldn't do it in consecutive days. And I burst his bubble by being like, look, I can watch all the episodes now. They're all on BBC previews. They're ready. That's just how they've literally decided to schedule it.
I read a feature about the whole process in the Times over Easter. And they did it all. I think they reshot the whole thing in 10 days. And obviously they didn't have to reshoot most of it. They could keep any of the scenes and any of the angles that Ed Westwick wasn't in. They just had to insert Christian Cook into the scenes. But because he plays Mickey Argyle, who's one of the siblings whose mother was supposedly murdered by their brother, he either speaks or is in a lot of the scenes, even if he's just like standing in the background while his siblings are talking. So they did have to, I think, reassemble the whole cast, which includes Bill Nighy as well as Anna Chancellor.
God, that must have been expensive, eh?
Yeah, so it's very interesting because I was thinking about this and I feel like even 5 years ago they wouldn't have bothered.
No,
they would have just shown it and like brassed out the controversy.
Totally.
But it's, you know, Me Too and Time's Up and all of that have made it unacceptable, which I think is a really positive change.
Yeah, it's a development that suggests at least some form of progress. So that's good, however you look at it. So yeah, I watched the first episode of this. I haven't watched the second two. I'm waiting for them to air properly. I'm not previewing them. And I don't know the book. I think you do know the book.
Yes. Interestingly, it's one of two of her novels that Agatha Christie personally said were her favourites that she'd ever written.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is interesting, I think, because I can't remember what happens in Crooked House, but this one certainly, it's not a spoiler to say that there's no like recognisable detective. It's one of her sort of ensemble psychological ones.
Yeah, it's interesting. And they've both been adapted this year.
Yeah.
But yeah, I spent quite a lot of time watching this episode trying to look for cracks in the shots where you could see that Ed Westwick should have been there, or is that actually the back of Ed Westwick's head, or blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't find any. They've done it very convincingly, I think.
They have, yeah. Kristin Cook was quoted in this piece I read in the Times as saying that when, because I think the interviewer asked him, like, how do you feel about being... like stepping into dead man's shoes,
symbolic,
essentially.
Yeah.
And obviously, because it's called Ordeal by Innocence and all the rest of it, it just gives a... And I don't think Ed Westwick has actually been convicted of anything, although there's been...
Anything, no, not at all.
Lots of allegations, et cetera, et cetera. And Kristin Cook just said, you know, I just said to the director that very happy to step in, but I'm not going to do an imitation of him. I'm going to act it and block it in my way, as long as you're happy to work around that. And I'm going to do the character my way. And then he also responded to the charge that I've seen some people say that, like, isn't it a bit of a kind of betrayal to, you know, allow this thing to actually be aired? Mm. And he was like, well, it's a job. And also a lot of people work very hard on it, both the other actors and people behind the camera, etc. And if I didn't, or if somebody didn't, it probably wouldn't have ever been aired.
Mm.
And their work would never actually be seen by anyone. So yeah, that was interesting. Just to but again, I feel a little bit sorry for the BBC and for the writer Sarah Phelps, because, you know, we've just spent like the first 5 minutes of our discussion talking about this. So just to focus briefly on what we actually thought of the adaptation, I don't like it very much.
Tell me your problems with it.
My problems with it are the excessive use of slow motion. And
I didn't even notice that.
Did you not? Like,
no.
God, every time they do a like flashbacky bit, which is a lot.
Yeah, you're totally right.
Like really dreamy, sort of weird, eerie music. And that's fine. Like a little bit of use of that can be very effective. But my husband and I were watching it and we were like, this is absurd. Every 5 minutes this happens, if not more. Also, and again, I don't know if this is a because of the way it was written or the way it's been shot, but for the first 15 minutes or so, I think it's pretty impossible to understand what's happening.
Yeah, I found it pretty confusing at the beginning.
There are a lot of characters, because as I say, the setup is that the adopted mother of 5 siblings has been murdered. They're all grown up and they've sort of all come back for their father's new wedding, for his remarriage. So there's just like a lot of young, attractive people about. And you don't really know who they are. And they keep throwing out names like...
And the fact that they're all adopted means there could be sexual tensions between them.
Yeah,
all
so,
brother and
so you can't even use that. And also, like, they have different races and all that kind of stuff. So you can't tell. It's like, is that the housekeeper? Is that her sister? Someone keeps saying, like, Hester's doing this. Who's this?
It took me ages. And in fact, my boyfriend who has read the book was like, at one point, I was asking all these questions. He was like, no, they're all adopted. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wait, what? I thought just the two that we saw being welcomed into the home as children were adopted and the rest were like biological. And he was like, no, they're all adopted. So I don't know if I even would have got that had he not been there.
Yeah. So I really felt like there wasn't a lot of help for the viewer to get into it. And as a result, I think you spend quite a lot of the first episode feeling confused and not a lot enjoying the actual plot.
Yeah.
So those were my main two problems with it.
It's also done the classic thing of just making everyone absolutely, totally unlikable.
Yeah.
And really playing that up loads, which is fine, you know, that I don't have any problem with that, but it kind of gets a bit tiresome after a while when you see so many that do that. Also, I'm like, okay, so the lore of most famous person is always the murderer suggests that either Bill Nighy, who so far has just been like the only one who's not reprehensible, is the murderer, or Matthew Goode, who always plays a total fucking psychopath, is the murderer. And
he was in Downton Abbey.
Yeah, he was actually.
Remember, and he wasn't
it's so
a
funny.
He wasn't a psychopath in that, but I kept waiting for him to become one.
Yeah. He's really weird because he's one of those actors who's like actually super famous and has been in like really big movies and has like been like the lead in big movies. And then he's also just like on ITV sometimes and you're like, wait, what? Matthew Goode? What are you doing here? but quite regularly. Mm. But it's funny. Yeah, so I don't know the solution, so, and don't spoiler me, so I might be totally wrong there. But already I'm a bit like, I feel like I can see sort of where this is going. I would like to shout out to Anthony Boyle, who we last saw on stage in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, who plays Jack, the dead and accused son. I just like to see him in things. I also saw him in Come Home, which is currently on BBC. Mm. And he's a great little actor. And I'm glad that he's got more roles off the back of The Cursed Child, because he was by far the best person acting-wise in that.
I think in other ways, this is a fairly typical adaptation in that, you know, it's set in a really bleak, remote country house.
When is it set as well? Because it seems later than an actual Agatha Christie.
It is. So it was, because, you know, she actually lived a really long time, Agatha Christie. Mm. This was first published in 1958. And I think it's to be set like early 1950s, maybe.
Okay.
Because there's in the adaptation, there's a little bit of like Cold War reference at one point.
They're talking about Korea and stuff, aren't they?
Yeah, and there's like Korea, and there's, you know, what to do in the event of nuclear fallout on the radio, that kind of thing.
And the dresses, which is obviously where I get all my period references from, because I don't understand politics, but hello, sweetheart neckline.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, it's definitely, it's not set in like the 30s or 40s, which is maybe what you expect
from
an Agatha Christie. Matthew Good's character was wounded and is in a wheelchair after serving during the Second World War. So it's definitely post-1945.
Already some sort of very questionable, potentially ableist quirks in his character, where he's like kind of, you know, bitter as a result of his injuries and is like super evil and like uses the wheelchair as like to play the victim when he's caught out being a villain, and which is just kind of the classic tropes of the disabled villain in all culture. I will keep watching it. I'm looking forward to, you know, I love a juicy Agatha Christie adaptation. I'll sit there, watch it with my big bowl of pasta. Dream Sunday night, isn't it?
Yeah, it fulfills that really, really well. I'm not sure, though, that it's necessarily much more than that. Like, I don't think it's going to survive as like one of the great Christie adaptations.
So, now it's time for the part of the show where we talk about a listener recommend. We've had a listener recommend and we have taken that recommendation. Caroline, do you have the email to hand?
I do. So this was from Jonathan, who is actually a long-time listener to the show, and says that this is his second email. He got in touch around this time 2 years ago when he was shuttling between a master's degree in London and his boyfriend in Paris, and there was a lot of train journeys, a lot of podcasts. He said, "You read out bits of my letter
I remember
and
this,
said
actually.
My trips on the Eurostar sounded glamorous, much to my friend's amusement."
I do remember that.
I do still think it's glamorous, Jonathan. Yeah, I don't care if it's funny. But anyway, so he's been listening all that time, so thank you very much for that.
Wow.
And I also like that he prefaces his recommendations with, "Mine are all a bit queer," which is good. Specifically, he says, "Finally, I want to recommend Tyler, the Creator's album Flower Boy, which was my album of the year last year. All I knew about him before was that he'd been banned from the UK by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary for some homophobic lyrics."
Yeah, exactly. That's what I remember that.
Same. Next thing you know, he comes out with this album. Far beyond the fact that it warms my heart to hear a rapper rapping about love for other men, it's exactly the kind of hip-hop I love, joyful, melodic, soulful. As much of a genius as Frank Ocean, only he takes himself less seriously, and you'd much rather go for a pint with him than Frank."
Oh, wow. He's done our job for us really well there. That's a great summation of this album.
Yeah, and also really nicely, he says, "I wish I'd had role models like them when I was growing up as a black gay boy in South London." So I'm very pleased that, you know, it gives you that feeling. That's very nice.
Yeah, and that he's filling that space.
Yeah, I think a lot of what Jonathan said there, I agree with. Like, I was blown away by this album this week. I'd not listened to it at all before. And like him, my only knowledge of Tyler was the Theresa May thing. When I first like opened this up on Spotify and I saw the list of people who'd collaborated on it, I was like, I think I'm going to like this, because it has Frank Ocean, ASAP Rocky, Anna of the North, Jaden Smith, and a load of like all people that I like.
Yeah, Anna of the North, someone who really would still be just so ridiculously niche if it wasn't for her collaborations with Tyler, the Creator. And so it's funny that we did her before we did him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting album. I think it's got that sort of really spacey quality that a lot of hip hop has at the moment. It reminds me of kind of a Frank Ocean. I guess he gets a lot of comparisons to Frank Ocean, but also maybe to like SZA's EP before her debut album.
Yeah.
Some of SZA's like early kind of demos. it's kind of everywhere, so it's kind of silly for me to pick out those two people, but that kind of echoey, summery, slow, melodic kind of backdrop, a lot of the samples really fill that space on this record.
Yeah, they're very melodic, actually. It's a really good word for it. It reminds me a lot of actually we talked about this a while ago, but that podcast about Kanye West, Dissect, had a whole episode on like the history of sampling.
Mm.
And it really went into detail about how like innovative Kanye was in sampling from old soul songs and then speeding them up or slowing them down. And I feel like what Tyler's done on this album is sort of very informed by that, because there's a lot of really interesting like vocal stuff in the background that has been taken from old songs.
Yeah, totally. I really like how funny he is as well. Yes. A lot of it
his lyrics are really funny.
I really like Boredom, which is the song with Anna of the North. Mm. But yeah, there are kind of moments where he'll come in with something quite punchy and something quite controversial and something quite rebellious, and you're a bit like, whoa, do I take this lyric seriously or not? Even because this album is kind of like almost considered to be like a coming out album, right? And even when he says something like how he's been, I'm paraphrasing, but it's a lyric that's a bit like, I've been kissing white boys since 2004.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny and silly, and I think it comes in I Ain't Got Time, where he's like talking about how he ain't got time for these hoes and these bitches. And then like, so he's like all this like crazy misogynistic bravado, and then it just is punctured by this like, oh, well, they'd be really surprised to know that I've been kissing white boys since 2004. I guess, as Jonathan says, it's that kind of slightly playful element where you're like, wait, do I take this seriously or not? And I had a few moments in this album where I'd be like, oh, that's really funny. Oh, am I meant to be offended by that? Or is this a joke? Mm. Like, oh, is he being serious and like really woke and intersectional here? Or is he actually not being serious at all? I think the complexity of the album is kind of what's nice about it in lots of ways.
Yeah. And I found it a really joyful listen, actually, for a lot of it. Yeah. Mm. So I think it's brilliant, and I'm very glad to have been introduced to it.
Yeah. Thanks so much. What a lovely recommendation. I feel like I see Tyler, the creator, always in like really beautiful editorials.
Mm.
He's always photographed so beautifully. And I've seen him photographed by people like Petra Collins in this very kind of like soft style that I really like. So he's a figure that holds some interest for me going forward. Yeah. So what about next week? What are we going to do?
So I have dipped back into the inbox, which contains a lot of your brilliant suggestions for things that we should watch, listen to, do, etc. If you want to add to it, by the way, you can at seriouslypod@gmail.com.
Feel free just to send us recommendations on how to live our life as well, because mine's a mess.
That would be great. Yeah, that would actually be really good. But in this case, we're going to take a tip from Madison, who wrote in last month to recommend a few things, but particularly we're going to pick out Bromans, which is a reality show from last year, she says, about men training and living as Roman gladiators.
I just so remember the adverts for this, really? And I so want to watch it.
Well, yeah. Apparently the girlfriends also come and have to compete in challenges.
I love that. The girlfriends can also come.
So yeah, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I think maybe my colleague Anoush at the New Statesman wrote about this last summer, and you know, it was great and funny, and I can't wait to watch this. And maybe I'll find my summer crush in the process. Who knows?
You will.
I doubt it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy, and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're SeriouslyPod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to, or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.